Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of INFORM, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm David Armstrong of the San Francisco Chronicle. Tonight we will take a closer look at doing business in China, part of our China Rising series, made possible by a generous donation from Dominican University of California. The rise of China may be the international business story of our times, with China's gross domestic product growing from 8 to 10% a year. Beijing has the world's fastest-growing major economy. With rapid growth comes opportunities and risks for U.S. businesses operating and investing in China, and for the Chinese themselves. Lured by the potentially lucrative Chinese market, American companies have found a very different business climate in China, which is still evolving from a socialist model to a hybrid form of state capitalism. U.S. businesses are concerned about a widespread lack of their intellectual property in China and by a $200 billion plus trade deficit with Beijing. China faces challenges from unemployment and pollution and pressure to keep growing at a breakneck pace. Therein lies the risks and the rewards of doing business in China. So that's the view from 35,000 feet. Tonight we'll take a look at China from sea level, grounding our discussion in real-world examples and personal experience. And to do that, we've assembled an impressive panel of China experts. Going from my left, your right, down the table, Victor Huang is the founder and managing partner of Agile Capital Partners. Prior to this venture, Victor was CEO and vice chairman of a Hong Kong exchange-listed venture capital company, ICG Asia, jointly owned by U.S.-based Internet Capital Group and Hutchison Whampoa, one of Hong Kong's largest publicly traded conglomerates. Claudia Fan Munts is managing director of IBM Venture Capital Group, as well as vice president, corporate strategy. IBM's VC group has a global reach and focuses on growth markets and emerging technologies. Jeff Grosskost is the CEO and president of AFV Solutions, Inc. AFVS, an alternative fuel vehicle solutions provider, is dedicated to seeking alternatives to petroleum as fuel for transportation. The company has an exclusive agreement with Shenzhen Xiwu Zulong Motors Group in China. Dr. Amy Xuan is a researcher and professor with the China-Europe International Business School, UC Berkeley, Haas School of Business, and the Wharton School. In addition, she recently developed and launched a bilingual Web 2 in China in-depth case-writing program for the financial, media, and location-based service travel sectors. Dr. Alexander Pan is a tax partner with PricewaterhouseCoopers private company services practice and has broad and deep expertise with respect to cross-border investment into the People's Republic of China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. Before joining PwC, he was an assistant professor with the School of Business Administration at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. So I'll throw some questions at the panel for the next 30, 40 minutes. And after we've all had a discussion up here, we'll throw the questions open to the floor so you can ask your questions, too. We can make the whole session a participatory one. So hopefully everyone will get to ask a question that they have in mind. One thing that strikes Americans when they go over to Asia, and particularly China, to start doing business there is how different the business cultures can be, how some of the operative assumptions that people in the U.S. assume are near universal turn out not to be true, and this in turn requires some adjustment and improvisation on the part of U.S. business people going there. So I'm wondering, starting with Alex, whether you have encountered indeed a different type of business culture, and you know, what differences you found.
In China, it depends on what type of the operation. What we commonly see is U.S. companies set up operation in China and make goods and sell the goods back to the U.S. That's a different culture, and you deal with the labor force, and you typically have the luxury to bring your U.S. management or some of the management recruit from Hong Kong or Taiwan, so you have a pretty much controlled environment. It's more a factory discipline. But recently, that China opened up its domestic market, and then it's a different environment because you're going to serve Chinese customer, and you're looking on different background of people to operate it, then they are still government regulatory environment, and you're dealing with the regulatory authority. So it's a very mixed business environment, and also the China law, they can issue law by the administrative branches of the Chinese government. So the law is not issued by one branch. It's a law issued by multiple branches. For example, foreign exchange regulatory authority, we have certain say the branch regulate foreign invest enterprise has a different say. So custom duty office will have a different interpretation. So it's very delicate to operate in China and to want to make sure you comply with all the law. That's the one of the greater challenge. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Victor, when we were talking today on the phone, you had an interesting comparison where you compared the business climate of China today with that of the United States in the 1920s. That really intrigued me. I wonder if you'd expand on that.
Sure. Thanks, David. First of all, thanks for having me here tonight, and thanks, Dave, for moderating. I'd like to just, before I go into that, just caveat that my investment experience in China was for the most part contained to 18 to 24 months, during which time I was pretty much focused on dot-com business plans, focused on the business-to-business space. It was kind of an interesting segment. That being said, there were some interesting conclusions that we drew during that time. I looked at about between 50 and 100 business plans with a team of about 15 investment professionals. The first thing that I sort of carry on is what David alluded to is, one thing that I took away from my time in China and looking at these different investment opportunities is, in many respects, investing in China today is a lot like investing in the U.S. in the 1920s. The vast majority of enterprises that you're seeing and sort of wealth that's being created is driven by, in many respects, the same analogous figures that you see in the U.S. economy back in the 20s. It's people who are building big infrastructure plans. It's the sort of next generation of Gettys, Rockefellers, and Stanfords of China. You have a lot of factory owners. What you don't have, and this is sort of somewhat of a stark difference as it relates to the venture environment here, is you don't have leading technology and innovation. What you have is labor and cost arbitrage, and that, for the most part, drives a lot of the business plans there. It's not driving the leading edge of the next generation of routing technology or semiconductor technology. A lot of it's driven, for the most part, by companies who have a cost arbitrage of manufacturing or labor. So that's another difference that we saw as related to a lot of the business plans that we saw in China. I think another difference that we saw is that there really is no dominant Fortune 500 to sell to. In China, you pretty much have a segregation of very small, fragmented businesses, many of whom these small factory owners, even if they're sort of achieving 10 to 20 or 30 million in revenues, they have a reluctance to spend on IT. You don't have the same fertile environment here where you have lots of billion-dollar companies who have discretionary corporate spend. And if you look at the history of the venture capital industry, the vast majority of dollars invested and dollars reaped in terms of investment profits, for the most part, fuel business-to-business plans, companies that are selling to the enterprise. In China, you just don't see that. It doesn't mean that it's not going to get there over time, but it was a stark difference. We went in thinking there'd be some interesting opportunities. The reality was it was a very, very different landscape. I think a third difference is something that Alexander alluded to, which is we definitely saw as related to entrepreneurs that there was much more of a command and control sort of mentality as related to the organizations. You didn't have the maturity or the depth in the management structure. A lot of times the companies were built by an entrepreneur who wanted to pass it on to their son or daughter, typically their son. And a lot of times it was also family run. And with that command and control philosophy, it's very difficult for an outside investor to come in and achieve a significant stake or exert any type of influence. So those would be some differences that I would highlight as it relates to looking at the investment landscape in China versus the U.S.
Any of our other panelists want to weigh in on this one? What did you find? Yes, please.
I'd like to weigh in on this because I've gotten back from teaching in China the last 2 years, and I actually felt there was an enormous difference over even 2 years ago. There are two reasons for that, I thought. The first one is we finally have a situation in China where broadband penetration is at a very high rate, so that you have lots of the city, even in the rural and the second and third tier cities and third and fourth tier cities, connected. And it's actually easier. I found it easier to use the internet and all of the features of almost a next generation internet broadband in China than I do here in Silicon Valley. This was amazing to me. The second thing is that we finally see the effect of perhaps what you have to call the unusual single-child policy generation. If you remember, China embarked on this amazing social experiment about 20 years ago, which was that they mandated that every family, particularly in the urban areas, even in the rural areas, they were very, very forceful about disciplining that you could only have one child. I mean, this was a major solution to their population overgrowth, because if you think of it, we're talking about, you know, the entire population of the United States is a rounding error in the population of China. We know that the population of China, I'm not exactly sure, something between 2.4 and 2.5 billion.
And I've seen all of them on the road at once.
Exactly. And all of the United States is something like 300 million. So it's a pretty staggering thought that in one fell swoop with this social policy, they were going to make their population growth decrease and make it possible to try and bring a higher level of education and focus on both boys and girls of that generation. So the students that I have in my MBA class are often in this single child who have grown up with six parents, their two parents as well as their grandparents, all sort of, these two sets of parents, all putting their attention on this one child and hoping this child succeeds in the new global environment. I think that's a very important social factor to look at, because these children are well-educated, they're an amazing sort of global digital generation, and they really are just hungry to sort of prove themselves in this new sort of global world where
let's come back to the whole digital and internet thing later in the conversation. I'd like to definitely explore that and round that out. I'm wondering too, Jeffrey, you're involved in a very different sector of the economy, building alternative fuel vehicles, buses, and you're involved in cars also. What's the experience been like for you?
Thank you, David, and building a little bit on what Victor had talked about. To use an analogy, any of you that have ever been to China, if you had been there 10 years ago, any of you that took, say, a trip and went to see the Great Wall, you would have seen large boulevards that looked like a bicycle factory exploded. I mean, there was bikes as far as you could see, completely containing the avenues. If you go over there now, you'll be hard-pressed to find a bicycle. And what you'll see is on a 10-lane, which is a very wide boulevard, you'll see 14 or 15 lanes of traffic. And it's what we like to call kind of a point-and-push driving model. If they can get one car between those two cars, all of a sudden there's a line, it's a new lane. For the next 5 miles, there's another lane there. And the way that I like to kind of contain that is to say, imagine most of these people have not been driving for more than 2 or 3 years. So imagine yourself in one huge high school parking lot. I mean, that's what it's like. Now, back to what Victor said, it's very similar in the business model. I mean, you have a very entrepreneurial society. You have some great merchants, and going way back, when I say way back, you know, we think a couple hundred years. They think a few thousand years and hundreds of dynasties back. You have storied experience in buying and selling and merchandising. And so you have kind of this common experience, but for the last 50 years or so in a socialist economy, that has not been tapped into. And so you have a lot of business, you have a lot of entrepreneurs that are doing exactly like what Victor said, and that is, for the first time, they're taking an idea, they're building a product, and they're trying to market it. And it's just like those cars. It's like nobody feels like there's any limit on what they can do. By the same token, the government is still trying to contain them all in that one avenue. And it's an interesting dichotomy. There are huge opportunities. We found, as David mentioned, we are in a joint partnership with Wujilong Motors, where we are building a hybrid electric bus that gets about a 35% efficiency premium on diesel. We're looking to homologate that so we can sell it in the United States. We're currently marketing it in India and Philippines and in South America. And we're also developing a pure electric bus, which our prototypes can do about 200 kilometers on a four-hour charge. The vehicles that we're developing up in Guangzhou, we're developing with highly skilled Chinese engineers that are exactly the products that Amy was talking about. And it is a society where you don't mortgage your house. You don't go put, you know, the car on a visa. You work and you, by and large, live in the factory until you have enough money that you can afford to get married. You marry someone who's been doing the same thing. You pool your resources. You buy a home, which is usually an apartment. I mean, it's not a large land space available. And then you work until you have the money to have a child. And then all of the resource goes into making sure that that child has the best possible education and can do anything, has the wherewithal to do anything they're capable of doing. And it is providing, exactly as she mentioned, a workforce that, in our development of the electric bus, I've got to tell you, some of the best engineers we've worked with anywhere in the world. So you have both ends of the spectrum. You have highly entrepreneurial individuals that are trying to start a company in a place where there's not many models. And it's interesting, the interactions with a socialist government as they move forward. And you have some pretty amazing opportunities as far as workforce. It's not just outsourcing for, you know, that cheap labor. It's also the fact that you've got some of the best, at least engineering schools in the world that are popping up and educating in China at this point.
Thanks, Jeff. I was wondering, too, Claudia, your activities representing IBM Venture Group. IBM, of course, being one of the most famous brands in the world, must be some people there who are hoping that the magic kind of rubs off. What is your experience being there with a really high-profile multinational? How realistic are the people who come to you in hopes of getting some seed money? What are some of the differences you perceive in the business culture there from, let's say, the U.S.?
Actually, that's exactly right, David. That brand is very strong. And with that, certainly make a lot easier for us to attract the entrepreneur and the venture fund, the small companies, to enter in a dialogue with us, IBM, giving the brands that we have and giving the market presence that we have in China. I actually was quite overwhelmed. We really focus on the Silicon Valley, Boston, Austin, U.S. Venture community for many, many years. And when we arrive in China, the energies that we have found of the China entrepreneurial community and the startup and the venture investor that are local to China, in terms of partnering with someone who's been playing the marketplace that they're trying to build technology solution to, it was tremendous. You know, we basically, you know, have more demand that we have the bandwidth to invest in working with these companies. I think one of the things that many mentioned, I think, is the hunger. Is they are so hungry to tap into this new opportunity in the IT space. And as Emmy mentioned, I actually found, you know, disagree somewhat with Victor that the I think the labor arbitrage is a thing of a past. I think really the high level skill resources is what is attracting more the venture community to China these days. We found tremendous innovation, both in the software and in the hardware space. People are building unprecedented, particularly for the broadband, the wireless broadband area. I mean, 1 million cell phones being activated each day is that ability to fill any new application, any new paradigm that you and I, you know, might still be sitting there wondering if it will happen, the level of acceleration pace that take place over there is just unimaginable. From 2 years ago, we were there and seeing some of these things starting to be developed to today serving the multinationals in China. China is indeed small, medium, you know, business predominantly, but what we forget is that multinationals has been moving that battleground that they've been fighting here in U.S. and also in Europe to Asia. So, you know, the IBMs, just in the IT space, the IBMs, the AT&T, the Ciscos, the Oracles, the Intels, they're all fighting that in that market. The financial services, the Visas, the American Express, they all fighting that marketplace. So definitely for us is a huge market to serve, and that brand is still something that they respect tremendously.
Doing interviews, as I do, with a lot of people from Hollywood and Silicon Valley who produce a lot of the intellectual capital that this country seems to be good at producing, are very concerned that they're not getting paid and they're not going to get paid, perhaps, in the near future for what they do. All of us who've traveled to China have probably had the experience of being in a public place and having someone come up and offer to sell a DVD of a brand new movie for about $1. This problem was supposed to be ended when China joined the World Trade Organization just under 5 years ago, but it still appears that there's a lot of work to be done. Well, this is a question for anyone on the panel who wants to have at it. What is your experience with protecting the intellectual property that you bring to the table, or perhaps the intellectual property of companies that you may invest in if you're investors?
Now, our firm representing quite a few U.S.-based MNC company operating in China, intellectual property, this is one of the major concerns, is how we're going to protect our intellectual property, either both legally and also if the violation, and how can get my loss recovered. It's a very, very challenging task. Even the China law protect intellectual property, but the enforcement of the intellectual property typically in the hand of the local authority, and the local authority, you just imagine that the whole system is well connected, so it's hard. So, but we have seen things are being improving, but also from the U.S. investor point of view, our advice to our client is not completely relying on the legal system, but there are certain mechanisms that should put into place and to protect your right. For example, if this is something that you want to protect your intellectual property right, and maybe you can think about to break down your operating, your China operation and the U.S. operation, and just make sure that you can at least have some operation side of the protection. That is a very challenging issue.
I have a very different viewpoint, and that is what we learned in Silicon Valley is there are two approaches. You can try and protect the property that you have, or you can run faster and innovate, and more people will try and follow you. And I think that that's really been the case in China, where, if anything, the difficulty with copying and piracy has created all sorts of new business models and innovations. So, for example, if it's easy to copy games, well, the biggest company that does electronic gaming in China has a sort of pay-for-play kind of model where people have to pay for their game as they play so that they cannot actually take a disc and actually distribute it. Well, I think that's an interesting solution to the issue, and it sort of says there are more than one way to deal with this competitive battle, and the companies that are going to sort of rest on their laurels and try and protect their intellectual property may be losing out on the battle, which is really a global battle in China against perhaps a European company that's going to move faster, or in the case of China, a Korean company that is going to innovate faster and steal the marketplace. So I would want to shift the focus away from resting on any kind of success recipe or laurels of the past and say that the direction that companies like IBM is moving towards in doing open kinds of source and systems where lots of people can play rather than, you know, one company monopolizes the marketplace seems to be the wave of the future.
Right. And David, I think that one of the issues is not just intellectual property, but also what that bundle that is intrinsically a company's core. For instance, in China, our partners, we have specifically structured our agreements with them where they will continue to market in China. And it's left in their hands to protect those assets which we vest them with. And ultimately, the value for us is what we are taking out of China. And, you know, if in fact they don't do a good job of protecting that asset, that really is pejorative to them, not to us. And it gives that incentive that they do go work with the various entities that Alex was talking about to make sure that, in fact, they're protected. They're much better than that than we could ever be, and we feel that we can adequately protect those assets we bring out of China. So you're seeing a hybridization of, back to what I said earlier, it's not what you are going to learn in business school. It's what you're going to figure out in order to make it successful within the dynamic that you're working. It's not static at all. It's a very fluid opportunity. It's a fluid marketplace.
Just to add a point, I think is certainly an issue that everyone that does business in China has to deal with, certainly intellectual property right, and something that I don't hear mentioned often enough outside China is, of course, the account receivable issue. Certainly the model. But I think what is going to change is really the what Amy said, the innovation pace in China. When China owns sufficient intellectual property of their own, and certainly they're in the very good pace for that, I think that is going to be when we're going to see really real measures that are executionable, enforceable happen at that point. Governments certainly are taking a lot of a direct measure. I'm still very bummed about the got rid of the Fashion Plaza in Shanghai, but you know, just 10% of GDP in China are in the counterfeit space. The culture is very ingrained in developing things off somebody else's brand, somebody else's rights. But I think once they have sufficient of their own rights to protect, then we will see the change.
Excellent point. Well, now China has Would you like to weigh in on that one, too?
No, I mean, I think I'd probably echo in particular what Amy said. I mean, as it relates to a lot of the businesses that we saw, we never banked on strong intellectual property protection. We, for the most part, were counting on the entrepreneur to out-execute the marketplace. I mean, I think particularly so in China, much more so than here in the U.S.
I'd like to add another point. Mm-hmm. I think when we talk about intellectual property right, then there's really there are different dimensions of the intellectual property right, where we have a trademark as one, where we see counterfeit brand name themes. But they are also processing know-how. That's my earlier comment, is more related to the processing know-how and copyright software. But I have seen recently some positive development. I believe the Chinese central government policymaker, they are convinced protecting intellectual property right is also for the best interest of China long-term economic development. Mm-hmm. Because what we have seen recently is China, for the next 5 years, they focus, want to develop industry with what they call, quote-unquote, core competency. That's basically is built upon the intellectual property right. We also see a lot of Chinese local-grown brand name, which they protect their quality and their defense, their intellectual property right, trademark, furiously. So I do see a positive trend. I think it's the central government, how much they can push down to the local government for enforcement. I think that's the only matter of time.
It sounds then like you're in broad agreement that market forces are taking care of some of these problems, and that as China becomes more a stakeholder in the world economic system, that progress will continue to be made on this issue. That's what it sounds, the gist of what you're saying. China, too, has, in terms of its rules and regulations, really opened up very quickly over the past 10 or 20 years, and it seems to be easier than before to operate in a regular market fashion. And yet it's really not quite an ordinary country yet. And I'm wondering what, in your various fields, what the regulations are in terms of, do you have to have a Chinese partner? How do you deal with some of the regulatory issues and the red tape to get yourselves going? How open is this marketplace now?
Now let me try that one. PwC did some study a couple years ago. We have found for the most of the joint venture with a local partner end up with very unsuccessful for a majority of that. That survey was pretty much based on one type of operation, is the manufacturing outsourcing. So in the very, very early day, the U.S.-based company went to China and they say we want a local partner, but typically you will find that the situation, someone claim they have a relationship there, they understand the local law, but turn out to be they are having a different agenda, maybe they want different things. So a lot of that kind of a joint venture end up with unsuccessfully. We look the past 10 years, so most of the outsourcing manufacturing operation in China is in the form of the wholly owned foreign enterprise. It's called WFOE, I mean wholly foreign owned enterprise. Now, it has been changed. 2004, December, China opened up its domestic market. When you open up the domestic market, typically you're looking for the Chinese market. And you need to expand. The U.S.-based company want to bring its service and product to China in the shortest period of time and to distribute to Chinese customer. And then recently, that type of the joint venture that we have seen that the local partner, they also become more disciplined, and the local partner see their own interests. They work with the U.S. joint venture partner and looking for providing service to Chinese domestic market. The financial industry, the banking industry, because of the regulatory requirement, for example, Bank of America invests in Construction Bank of China, is regulated, so they have to form the joint venture. They can take a percentage up to to 20% for each foreign enterprise. So they're different sector. They're different sector. So the early day, the manufacturing side, it's very bad experience, but now the local market open up, it's a different story though. But still we have to watch out.
In addition to U.S. companies doing business in China, of course, Chinese companies want to do business in the United States as well. And, of course, you remember the political flap in this country about a year ago when the Chinese oil company wanted to buy Unocal and was blocked from doing so on national security grounds. What's your take on that? Was that an overreaction? Was that xenophobia on the part of Americans?
Let me jump into that. I'm not sure that it was, I mean, heavens, I don't want to limit Americans to only xenophobia and overreaction, but I think that beyond that, that probably the concerns that I saw and actually was watching it through a different lens because we were actually in Beijing at the time that was happening with CNOOC, and we're doing business with CNEC, which is CNOOC's equivalent in the heavy equipment and electrical components end of the government. But what I really sensed and the take that I heard in Beijing was that the concern that they felt was that they were being blocked because they would have blocked a similar acquisition in China. And in that same context, locally, I heard officials, and we were at that point dealing with some of those individuals, talk about the liberalization of the policy and the point that they understood that if they wanted to make those acquisitions, those acquisitions had to be available to foreign investors. And in the last year, because it's been about a year, I've seen some of those, I guess, baby steps begin to occur. And in fact, we are working towards acquiring a majority share of one of the companies that we're working with. And that in 2007 will become a possibility for us in the sector that we're in. So I think that's kind of the push and shove and a little give and take that goes with a growing emerging economy. And I think that you'll see it become more liberalized as they get more time on task and as they move towards a more pure capitalist society. It's not a capitalist society at this point.
Not yet. Thank you, Jeffrey. If people want to ask questions from the floor, there's a microphone stand in one of the aisles, and I think it's sort of first come, first serve. In about 4 or 5 minutes, we'll take the first questions from the floor. We're not quite there yet, but we will be there very shortly. Certainly the internet space is an important part of business these days, almost regardless of what business you're in. And some of the major Silicon Valley companies like Yahoo and Google have gone into China and adjusting to local conditions. They've been criticized sometimes for that in this country. I'm wondering to what extent the transformative power of the internet might still be able to take hold in China over time, or do you see perhaps this is an interesting and unique test case in which the internet might actually be curbed to some degree over the long term? And Amy, I think you were sort of heading in a direction that might be, you might want to address that.
I did want to say two things about that. It is pretty amazing how quickly next generation internet has taken off in China. A part of it is because it is a way for young people in everywhere from the third to fourth tier cities to find out about what's going on in the rest of the world. It really is difficult to actually screen out all of the information that's available in English on the web. And even within these small rural communities, you have people who are meeting other people, other farmers from other locations and matching up over the web. You have a number of the things that are just, you know, that we take for granted here in the States as being sort of next generation web, you know, MySpace kinds of things and American Idol happening in China on a large scale. And this only maybe in the last year and a half. So you can imagine that when you go into a Shanghai train station and you're in what is it called? commuter, you're in rush hour, and you look at what we have in BART as being just your schedule, that now is going to be completely connected to the internet, and there will be media and advertising and whatnot that can be beamed over there as well as your train schedule. And so these are the sort of things that are happening when this infrastructure can, you know, and wireless infrastructure and broadband has taken place in such a large area. Lots of interesting innovations happen as a result.
Thanks so much. Does anyone else want to tackle the internet question in 60 seconds or less?
I think it's an easy, simple answer of lack of inertia. I think it's very easy to really understand when, just look at your kids versus your parents on internet. You know, their lack of inertia and also the fast pace of adoption. I think it's very clear to see, you know, the internet is going to be a much more powerful tool over there for simple, you know, answer of inertia.
Okay.
Am I allowed to add, even though I go over the time quickly? The one thing I want to add very much so along the lines of what Amy and Claudia said is, for me personally, it's fascinating. When I was looking at some of these investments back in 2000, 2001, a lot of people forget that many of the internet plays that have now become sort of the success stories that people hold up were actually considered kind of secretly bad deals at the time. The people sort of thought it was a little bit of a joke to try to create a Yahoo in China. It was kind of a little bit of a joke to try to create an eBay in China. And in many respects, the wireless broadband revolution has happened much faster, much quicker in the last 5 years than, you know, maybe many of us could have predicted. But that's really what is fueling the success of these stories, is this next generation of technology. And I think that's a whole set of innovation, a generation of entrepreneurs. In many respects, the revenue streams associated with that are what save those companies, not traditional online advertising revenues, but wireless services. And I think that's really much more akin to why you see such a kindred spirit between Silicon Valley and China today.
Thank you, Victor. In just a moment, we're going to take questions from the floor. But before we do that, as a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inform program. And tonight, we're taking a closer look at doing business in China, part of the China Rising series, which is made possible by a generous donation from Dominican University of California. I am David Armstrong of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I am here with Victor Huang, founder, Agile Capital Partners, Claudia Fan Munts, Managing Director, IBM Venture Capital Group and Vice President, Corporate Strategy, Jeff Grokost, President and CEO of AFV Solutions, Dr. Amy Schwan, Researcher and Professor, China Europe International Business School, UC Berkeley Haas School of Business and the Wharton School, and Dr. Alexander Pan, Partner, PricewaterhouseCoopers Private Company Services Practice. Now let's go to the audience for questions. And we're just taking you first come, first serve. As you come to the microphone, if you have a question for a specific member of the audience, then direct it to that person.
Just for everybody. My impression of many Chinese in China is they will sell their grandmother on eBay given half the chance. Even overseas Chinese got burned. For example, a few years ago, the Singaporean government with extensive political connections got burned, and the ex-prime minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, came out in the media and complained about it. So basically, there's so much corruption. The legal system is just a basic rubber stamp for the corrupt Communist Party, and there's very little respect for commercial law and contract law. So what made you guys so optimistic about the progress in China?
I did actually read the memoirs of the Prime Minister of Singapore about that one incident, and he put it as being a big difference, and it is still a big difference, between a very firm, you know, our understanding in the United States and in Anglo-Saxon law of contracts being exactly as written to the letter, and here where there was an interpretation of what could be done that played in very much to the benefit of the Chinese province that took over essentially a lot of the manufacturing and research park that Singapore had invested in.
Anyone else want to
just the nature of doing business. There are always the risks, and there's always the return. And certainly, you know, as they say, you miss 100% of the shots that you do not take. The China market certainly is a high-return market, and certainly, as you mentioned, the risk is there.
And David, I think I would mirror those comments that when we started moving forward and started capitalizing at a heavy rate in China, it certainly was something that our board was very leery about, and exactly for the reasons that was mentioned by the questioner. But I think that ultimately it comes down the way that we have hedged or tried to protect our investment has been with our local partners. And we've had experience doing business in South America in other places where, unfortunately, you don't have the same governmental dynamic, the same business ethos, the same expectations when you enter into those agreements. And, you know, frankly, it's not a lot different whether you're doing business in, you know, Guangzhou or whether you're doing it in Lima or in Sao Paulo or in Mexico City or in the Philippines. You know, there's not necessarily the same expectation that you have if I was coming here to San Francisco to set up a bus factory. So that is, there's no question, it is different. Claudia hit it on the nail. There is a high return available, but it, as with any high return, there is a high risk.
Thanks very much.
Could I just mention one thing? Okay. Also, you know, there are lower entry barriers, so the cost of getting in is not any different than for established companies that are in the market. But the big difference that both Claudia and Jeff have mentioned is there are areas of quicksand that there are clearly higher risks that might not be visible to a player just entering the marketplace.
Let's take our next question from the floor.
Some have predicted that the U.S. market is going to face a slowdown in the next 20 years. And with the death of the American dream, is there a Chinese dream? And I also want to know which capitalist system is China copying, or are they coming up with their own? And on the pessimist side, can you guys tell us what could China do to play into its own demise for the second time?
Let me jump into the first half of that, David, just because as for those of you that haven't read the bio, I'm a recovering politician, and I have a hard time not jumping into it. First of all, the question is, what model are they following? They're following the model that keeps them in power.
Okay.
Plain and simple. They are bleeding out. They've watched what happened with Yeltsin. They've watched what happened in Russia, a revolution that was led by access to television sets. As you've heard these panelists say, that is exponential with access to the internet. And so what they're trying to do is hold on to as much power as they can continue to control. They do that because it is very much a market-guided economy. Mm-hmm. The people that we're doing business with, they're selling more units because of the overseas production. Because of that, they get more concessions, they get more land. They cannot own land any other way. And so the huge benefit for them is to partner with us. The benefit for us is that obviously we have access to technologies. So that's, I mean, that's the model that they're following. Having said that, you know, there is an amazing upside. And that upside is going to be, you've heard people talk about the amazing generation that is occurring in China, probably accidentally as an attempt to control the population. What you have, as Amy very articulately said, is six educated parents that are all cramming everything they can, trying to vest it into this one child. And eventually you're going to have a generation that's going to say, where do we want this to go? And that generation that is trying to control them, as we all know, doesn't have a clue what they can do technologically. I still take my new cell phones and give it to my 15-year-old son, let him have it for a week, and then he shows me how to use it. And so I would be in a very poor position to try and regulate someone that understands more than I do the opportunities available. And that's what they're going to find themselves in.
Let me try to answer your question from a different angle. One of your question is what capital system China tried to develop. But Let me try to answer your question a different way. I can say that for the past 20 years, China's economic policy is pretty much learned from the Taiwanese experience. In a short summary, is to use the they call processing trade, means export processing, bring the raw material in and have a simple processing assembly, create job and sell goods, export, and then create job and create a job opportunity. This going back to Jeff's comment, the central government's most important agenda is to maintain the political stability and to create hope. Then people getting better economically, and then we'll work with the central government. Now, each local government are competing the foreign investment. You can find Guangzhou is competing with Shenzhen. Shenzhen is competing with Shanghai. Shanghai is competing with somebody else, some other province. The government official, the local government official, their scorecard is measured at least partially, if not a major factor, is how much business they bring in, the economic opportunity create. Now, this is to a point that China will try to come up with their own model. That model will probably nobody know, because China can no longer export goods to maintain its 10% or 9% GDP growth. There's no way. U.S. won't allow it. EU won't allow it. China is looking for the domestic market. Last year, China's one-third of the economy is from the domestic market. Now, how that's going to evolve, nobody knows. But that's clearly the direction. Maybe it's Chinese own model.
Thanks so much. Let's take our next question from the audience.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Jim Walton, and I have a small business in Sebastopol. I have a small high-tech business that works in machine vision and develops software and systems integration of machine vision systems. This is a real-world problem for me, and listening to you folks this evening is very interesting, because obviously the IP issue is of concern. It's been a major topic here tonight. In 4 weeks, I will be in Beijing, taking our software and talking to people at Beijing Institute of Technology, Changsha with the National Defense University, in Xi'an with the Northwestern Polytechnic. I will be talking with colleagues who I have very warm relationships with and collegial relationships with in these institutions. I feel confident in their protection for me, but I am not the multinational that Amy says can run faster than the little guy. The multinationals can afford to do this. They can ramp up and keep going faster and faster and leave these little guys behind. But I'm the real-world little guy that has the small business that wants to approach the Chinese market and maybe sell a product there. But I have people on both sides of the fence. My own advisors are telling me, don't do it, stay away. And my colleagues in China, who I feel very good about, are telling me, go for it.
Thanks so much.
Can I have your take on that?
What can the little guy do?
I don't mean to monopolize this, but let me just tell you what we did, because we are relatively small in our we're large in our space, but the space is very small. We formed a partnership with the CNEC, which is one of the eight largest branches of the government, if you will, that function economically in China. And frankly, it's a partnership that we feel very comfortable with. It's a partnership that does offer us the protection that you're talking about, and it allows us the ability to move downstream and do what we need to do without having that be our dominant concern, whether or not we're going to lose our technology. And my suggestion for you is, whether it's through university, whether it's through polytechnology, whether it's through who it's going to be through, that you form a partnership, that you make them a partner by giving them a share of the proceeds, and that you share with them what you're wanting to protect because there's really no other way to guarantee. I mean, that's half of our discussion up here. There's no other way to guarantee that you are going to be protected when you enter that market unless you have somebody on the ground who's willing to fight for it because they have a stake.
Any other advice on getting started?
It's a very challenging situation. If you're a big company like IBM, you still can rely on the legal system, the contractual arrangement, because you still can sue them. But for a small scale, this area should be extremely careful, and you should revisit what your business model, whether you can retain a core piece here in the U.S. and only do a piece in China, or you can test the water and to see how things going, or if you be able to structure some joint venture but have that exit strategy become outside China, be IPO here in U.S. And there are different ways, but one thing for sure, this is what maybe one of the most important issue you should really take a hard look, because it's a danger zone and plenty of opportunity, but you need to figure out a way to mitigate the risk.
Thank you. Yeah. Let's take our next question from the audience.
Hi. I'd like to know, since the Cultural Revolution and all that came after that hurt education so badly in China, how do they catch up so fast? How do they produce these wonderful engineers, for example? How do they have such good schools so quickly?
Let me try on that one. The disco can trace all the way back to my personal point of view. I think it can trace all the way back to the late Qing Dynasty. And China at that time tried to figure out what's the right model for China's social, economic, political system. And there's different thoughts. Okay. And then the Cultural Revolution is really put an end for the whole thing, because all the thought has been tested to the full extent. Then after that, and people, and as well as Deng Xiaoping kind of lay out these things, white cat, black cat, as long as can catch mice, it's good cat. Okay, so then just looking on that pragmatic form, that the student return to school, even they are only a few, it's a whole generation get lost, but there's still some student get back to school. They are so hungry for knowledge. They are so hungry for a career, because they have seen what it will lead them to if they push the ideology and push this communist idea to the full extent. It's not for themselves. It's not for the country. So we found there's a lot of a political leader this day. They come out from the late stage of the Cultural Revolution, and there are a lot of engineers that they kind of at a late stage return to school. They have a very strong desire to learn and to be successful.
And yet the schools were still there to teach them after they had been stalled for so long.
When you look on the prestigious schools such as Beijing University, Tsinghua University, you're talking about from the elementary school, you're probably talking about like 100,000 students that can only one can get to that school. So they are so hungry for the knowledge. They try very, very hard.
Thanks so much for that question and answer. I have to jump in only because we're running out of time, and I'd like to move at a brisk pace for both questioners and answerers just to get as much ground covered as we can.
Yes, okay. Yes, no, yes.
I make it look fast. My name is Diana Liu.
Shortest speech by a politician ever.
Okay. My name is Diana Liu. I am the author of a best-selling book, Daughter of Yellow River. I have a major question for Jeff. How do you think the cynical issue is not just paranoid reaction from the U.S. government? Because we have another serious issue, Lenovo's large sales rejection by U.S. government, hires emerging by another rejection by the government. It's become so obvious U.S. government try to stop the China's economic growth.
Well, and I guess I would take that in a more global view. It's not just China. I mean, how would you feel if you were in the Arab Emirates right now trying to, you know, acquire business share in the United States or other areas? There's always been a strong xenophobia in Congress. Congress responds, they legislate by antidote, not necessarily by intelligent thought processes. We've always understood that. But having said that, and knowing some of those individuals that I just impugned, I think one of the biggest things that they are looking for is for some sort of parity, and the idea is to push the Chinese government to open up to the point that we could acquire the same business sector in China that they're asking to acquire here.
Well, I want to address that. If you look at the automobile industry, almost 56% of a mechanical factories, automobile makers are merged by U.S. or foreign investors. China is the most open market ever in this world. But look at the future trade deficit here.
Thanks for that question. We're all only down to about 1 minute here. And so if anyone would like to come in on this, they may. If not, we'll move on and try to squeeze in one more question.
I'd love to talk to you more about it afterwards. Yeah.
Let's try one more question. And also to members of the audience who are physically here, the panelists will be available for a while. Let's try to get someone else to also be able to ask a question.
Okay.
Just share the space with them.
All right. Thank you.
Very quickly, I'm afraid.
Thank you. In your observations, what values would you say we share with China and the Chinese culture and society at large? And what values we don't share at all, and where do you see a potential for future conflict?
In essentially no minutes. Who wants to go? Who wants to take that and answer with a witty epigram?
I think one value for sure share is for profit.
And
what is need to watch out, my personal point of view, is a national pride. So that's a very dangerous need to be watch out.
We are out of time, unfortunately. We could go on for much longer with a topic this complex, but we don't have any more time. So would you please join me in thanking the panelists? Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.